KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
As long as these children remain in the camps, the international community faces a serious humanitarian problem.
What happened to the children of Americans who fought for ISIS?
More than a dozen American kids remain in Syria.
It's Wednesday, May 28th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, it's nearly 5 months since the start of the LA wildfires.
How is the cleanup and rebuilding going?
So I think now it's a really sign of hope.
Also, new questions about a new aid program for Gaza.
Today saw the storming of a United Nations food warehouse by Palestinians desperate for something to eat.
And why are physical attacks against cryptocurrency investors on the rise?
Even if you have really, really good digital security, if you're being beaten with a wrench, you're probably going to tell the password.
The strange saga of a Bitcoin kidnapping after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal court has blocked President Trump's worldwide tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the U.S. Court of International Trade says the president overstepped his authority in taxing imports from nearly every other country.
In a unanimous ruling, the three-judge panel said the Constitution gives Congress the exclusive power to regulate trade and impose tariffs. The court says the 1977 emergency law Trump relied on in ordering tariffs does not give the president unbounded power to tax imports from nearly every other country. If that ruling stands, it would strike down all the tariffs that Trump ordered on April 2nd, as well as separate taxes on imports from China, Canada, and Mexico, some of which have been temporarily suspended. The tariffs were challenged by a dozen states and five businesses. The three judges who ruled against the president were appointed by Presidents Reagan, Obama, and Trump himself. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is out with a plethora of pardons today. According to White House officials, Trump has pardoned former Republican Representative Michael Grimm, who served 7 months in prison for tax fraud a decade ago, along with rapper Kentrell Golden, who was sentenced to 2 years ago in a federal gun case. He commuted the sentence of Chicago gang member Larry Hoover, who was serving multiple life terms for crimes including murder. Trump also apparently pardoning former Connecticut Governor John Rowland, who left office amid a federal corruption investigation and later pleaded guilty to tax fraud. The Department of Health and Human Services has canceled the federal government's only contract to develop a vaccine to protect people against bird flu virus that experts fear could cause a pandemic. Here's NPR's Rob Stein.
Federal officials are canceling a contract with Moderna to develop an mRNA vaccine to protect people against flu strains that could cause pandemics. That includes the H5N1 bird flu virus that's been spreading among dairy cows in the U.S. The cancellation comes even though the company says a study involving 300 healthy adults has produced positive results. An HHS spokesman says the contract was canceled because of concerns about the safety of mRNA vaccines. Rob Stein, NPR News.
With its war against Russia's invasion of Ukraine dragging on, Germany now appears ready to step in and fill some of the void left by a lack of Western assistance. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz promising to help Ukraine develop its own long-range missile systems would be free of Western-imposed limitations. President Trump today, meanwhile, downplayed the possibility of new sanctions against Russia, saying he expects to know in a week or two whether Russian President Vladimir Putin is committed to ending the war against Ukraine. Stocks added to their losses late in the session. The Dow was down 244 points to 42,098. The Nasdaq fell 98 points. The S&P dropped 32 points. This is NPR. Singer Smokey Robinson has filed a countersuit against the former employees who accused him of sexual assault earlier this month. As NPR's Neda Ulubi reports, Robinson claims the women are guilty of defaming him.
In the suit filed in California Superior Court, Smokey Robinson and his wife Frances say the four women are extorting them. Robinson became known for a string of Motown hits in the 1960s. The women worked as housekeepers for the couple. They accused Robinson of multiple instances of rape in a civil lawsuit. The Robinson's countersuit claims the accusers demanded $100 million before taking legal action and seeks damages of $500 million. The Robinson's lawyers also argue in a separate filing that the women, who filed anonymously as Jane Doe's, lacked the legal standing to hide their identities. A criminal investigation into the women's claims is ongoing. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Astronomers are still puzzling over the discovery of a new object in our Milky Way they say is emitting X-rays around the same time. It's also shooting out radio waves. Located some 15,000 light years away, scientists say they're not sure if the object is a star, a pair of stars, or something else entirely. NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory spotted the emission by chance last year while focusing on the remains of an exploded star. They say the hyperactive phase of the object lasted for about a month. The findings were published in the journal Nature. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up 95 cents a barrel to $61.84 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When ISIS was at its height, its ranks included several hundred Americans. They were often young men, radicalized online by savvy marketing that promised free housing and the chance to meet a wife. When the Islamic State collapsed, some of them ended up in huge detention camps in Syria, and the U.S. has been trying to bring them home. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer reports on one American family coping with the aftermath of the child they lost and the children they found.
A decade ago, a Minnesota man named Ahmed woke up during a family vacation in Morocco and discovered that his 18-year-old son, Abdelhamid, had disappeared.
I was thinking that he left the house, you know, going for a walk or something and like, attacked or something like that. So, auto accident.
It turned out their son had flown to Turkey and from there crossed into Syria and Iraq.
Police told us that when a kid or a young man leaving without telling their parents their destination, I guarantee he went there to join some radical groups or something like that.
His son, a U.S. citizen who'd grown up in the suburbs of Minneapolis, had joined ISIS, one of the most violent jihadist groups in the world. Ahmed and his wife were stunned. They asked that NPR not use their full names because they're concerned about the security of their family. They traveled home from vacation without their son, but he occasionally called from overseas, and he eventually shared more surprising news.
When he was in Syria, most of the time he called us from there, sent us pictures of his kids.
Abdelhamid had gotten married and had two children. That meant Ahmed and his wife were grandparents to a pair of little boys they'd never met. Then, for nearly a year, they stopped hearing from Abdelhamid until he appeared on CBS News in 2019.
Did you not know that it was a terrorist organization when you joined it?
To be honest, I was kind of a conspiracy theorist a little bit.
Their son was in a Syrian prison. He had two broken legs and a stump for one arm.
What did you think when you saw that TV interview?
How had he changed?
I mean, he was too skinny and malnutrition, you can tell.
Abdelhamid said his wife had been killed in Iraq, and after that, he surrendered and his children were taken away. He had no idea where they were, but his parents were determined to find them. So they wrote an email to former U.S. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who read their message to me later.
Hello, Mr. Galbraith. I'm writing to see if you can help me in finding my two missing grandchildren.
Galbraith has helped get about 30 children of various nationalities out of Syrian camps holding ISIS fighters and their families. He wondered if Ahmed's grandchildren were there, so he used his connections to contact the camps.
I sent them photographs electronically, you know, prior to going there, along with the names, the dates of birth, the parents.
Then Galbraith made three trips to Syria to look for the boys. On the third, camp officials brought him two children who seemed to be the kids he was searching for.
I did have a photo of their father. You know, I showed it to them, and they didn't recognize him. But I was quite sure that these were the correct children.
A DNA test proved their identities. Then a network of U.S. government agencies worked together to get the boys out of the camps and to the United States. Last May, after a year and a half of complicated negotiations, the two boys flew to New York. A former State Department official named Ian Moss was one of the people who welcomed them at JFK Airport.
They certainly were scared. I think they were also just confused. They'd been on 20-some hours of flights and are now, you know, arriving at 3 o'clock in the morning at JFK to meet with grandparents that they'd only seen via video. It had to be disorienting, to say the least.
But that middle-of-the-night airport arrival marked the beginning of their new lives.
And to be there for that first moment when the boys were walked back to meet their grandparents, who, like, you could just feel that they were greeted with so much love, balloons, and everything.
I met the boys late last summer as they were finishing their first week of school in Minnesota. Every day, their grandparents greet them at the bus stop when they come home.
Hey, how you doing?
How is school?
Their grandfather, Ahmed, has been showing and teaching them everything he can, from swimming to drawing to growing tomatoes.
Because they never been in school, just was a small classroom. They can attend a school for 1 hour back there in Syria. But now they really appreciate it because every day is a new day to them, going to school and learning things that they never saw actually or touch. So they love it.
What kind of things would they not have touched?
A lot of things. Fruits, toys, technology around them too, so.
They live near the boys' school. We took a one-floor elevator ride up to their apartment.
This is the apartment.
Go ahead.
You want to have a seat?
The grandkids arrived in the U.S. speaking mainly Arabic, but that's quickly changing. I asked them what classes they like in school.
English.
And what toys?
Spider-Man.
And what shows they're watching?
Tom, Jerry, Mr. Bean.
They tell me their favorite English words so far are, how are you? So we test that out.
How are you? Good.
So I say, how are you? You say,
good.
Good. How are you?
How are you?
You want to? Do you want to ask me?
Oh, good.
Uh-huh. You want to have him ask me?
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
They like outdoor sports and indoor games.
You can play chess?
Yeah.
He's good at it.
I ask them where they learn to play. They respond with an Arabic word.
Minasijin.
It means jail. They use that word a lot. It's what they call the place where they lived in Syria after their dad was taken away. They mention it casually. After all, it was their home for 5 years, the only home the younger one really remembers. When they describe what it was like, these little boys start matter-of-factly telling startling stories.
كان هناك ما بأكل كثير، أكل أي شيء. حتى الرمل يأكله.
He said he used to grab some erasers for crayons, put them in his pocket, and later start chewing them like a chewing gum. Yeah, I said, why? And he said, because there was not enough food.
Ahmed and his wife know their grandkids might need counseling someday to process everything they've gone through. But they say bringing these children into their home has brought them tremendous joy.
I feel like I'm more power, I'm more young, more... Yeah. I'm not feel like I'm tired, I'm feeling...
We feel younger.
Yeah, we feel younger for these kids. I start playing with him, I start... Maybe this time I'm not with my kids, I do now with my grandkids.
I did not expect that answer at all. I thought it was going to be that you were more tired.
No, believe me not. Like if you see kids coming from different country, what happened with him before, and you want to give him everything, you want to see him happy. I'll never shopping for my kids like I shopping for my grandkids. I'm serious, you know.
Because you want to spoil them more, or?
This is how you express your joy.
You know what I mean? Oh, finally, we got them. Yeah. It's like a compensating ourselves and them, whatever happened in the past, bad things that, you know, happened in the past. We will just make them happy, and we are happy.
Might I invite you to take your seats?
In Washington, D.C. last fall, officials from across the Middle East, Europe, and Asia gathered to talk about the dangers posed by the roughly 35,000 people still being held in Syrian camps. Richard Verma was with the U.S. State Department until January.
More than 25,000 of the displaced persons are children, growing up in dire conditions without access to education, opportunity, or social support.
The United States has brought about 30 American kids home from the camps, but more than a dozen are still there. The U.S. has also brought back American adults, some now behind bars, like Ahmed's son, Abdelhamid, who was sentenced last year to 10 years in U.S. federal prison. But Verma said getting kids out is even more critical.
As long as these children remain in the camps, the international community faces a serious humanitarian and a potential future security problem.
Some countries have resisted bringing home the children of ISIS fighters out of fear they could be a security threat. But Moss views those kids as innocent victims of poor decisions made by their parents. He says if the camps aren't dismantled, they could produce future terrorists.
People will continue to exist. You can pretend as if this is a problem somewhere else, but you don't know what the future holds. Like, that problem could be on your doorstep if you don't do anything about it.
The U.S. is pushing other nations to reduce the number of people in the camps by taking back their citizens. And Moss says the Minnesota family, Ahmed, his wife, and their grandchildren, are a model success story so far.
These two boys are now living with their grandparents and building lives and doing well. That we were able to keep a family together meant the United States was able to lead by example.
Ahmed and his wife say they are grateful for the United States government's efforts to reunite their family. And they say once Abdelhamid is released from federal prison, they want him to live with them. That would reunite their long-missing son and long-missing grandchildren under the same roof.
We feel relieved now. We got our kid back and we got our grandkids back. I mean, life is beautiful now, to be honest.
Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Los Angeles is approaching the five-month mark since January's deadly wildfires. And federal cleanup crews are months ahead of schedule removing burned debris from thousands of properties. City leaders now say the recovery is on pace to be the fastest in modern California history. But the reality on the ground is more complicated. NPR's Kirk Sigler explains.
On a recent morning, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass celebrated a milestone, standing beaming in front of one of the first homes being rebuilt in the Pacific Palisades.
They're moving at lightning speed, expediting the timeline to get families home.
Hammers pounding behind her, the scene is a sharp contrast to 5 months ago when the mayor was facing calls to resign for being out of the country when the wind-driven fires ignited. But on this morning, it's good news. Almost a third of all the burned lots in the Palisades are now cleared of debris, a required step toward rebuilding.
It's my job to make sure that the process goes smoothly, goes quickly, and is safe, and that people rebuild fast, but they rebuild back better.
Rebuild back better for Bass means building to safer fire-resistant codes. The city is also waiving building permit fees that can cost tens of thousands of dollars.
Wow, I mean, this is happening, you know, I want to move back.
This home's owner, Walter Lopes, stood back kind of in disbelief.
So I think now it's a really sign of hope.
I mean, there's hope because federal crews are cleaning burned lots at a historic pace, faster than the early months after the campfire burned down Paradise, California, or those deadly fires on Maui. The acrid smell of burned metal and plastics has only gone away here some. There's still a ton of alarming destruction. And to be clear, many survivors have yet to even resolve insurance claims. Maya Rahperi and her husband, Hussein Hashimi, have been staying in his parents' small apartment near the 405 freeway.
I'm living in someone else's house right now.
And we don't have a local community.
The couple lost everything in the Palisades. Hussein is back teaching at USC, and Maya is getting some work again as an occupational therapist. On a table is tea and fresh pistachios her family sent from Tehran as comfort food. They're stressed that their insurance isn't going to pay out.
Even if we like sell our land right now, let's say for $1 million. With $1 million, you're not lucky to find a good house in LA, in a good neighborhood.
You know, we're trying to rebuild, but our friends and family are saying that, are you sure it's not going to happen again?
And they worry if it's even safe to go back. Federal crews are now removing the top 6 inches of soil from burned lots. In a statement to NPR, FEMA says that's sufficient to take care of contamination, pointing to data from recent LA fires. In late January, President Trump ordered the fast-tracking of debris removal. Today, a growing number of scientists like Andrew Welton are worried that cleanup is happening too fast.
People need to build back. They need to rebuild. They need to know that they can bring their kids back to their properties without jeopardizing their health and future.
Welton is an engineer at Purdue University and is nationally known for exposing hazards that crop up after disasters. In Paradise, his team discovered that the town's entire water system was contaminated. He's walking a street in Altadena where lots were recently cleaned and smoothed out.
What we can't see is whether or not there are any other hazards there.
Signs posted along the sidewalk indicate it's okay to start building here.
You know, how much lead is on the site? How much arsenic? How much cadmium?
Welton is in L.A. pushing for more testing of soils after the lots are cleared. The feds are not, which he says is a departure from what's now standard protocol after urban wildfires.
It's unclear to me why this is different, but it clearly is, and this is a problem towards a safe and rapid rebuilding.
Last week, LA County did approve a soil testing plan for the Eaton fire after county health officials found more than a quarter of the properties scraped by federal crews still had toxins above California standards. And in the Palisades, LA Mayor Karen Bass says the city is looking for private groups to step in and test.
So speed does not necessarily mean at all, or cannot mean, that rebuilding would be done in a sloppy manner or that we would skip steps.
But no matter how many more steps they say they'll take, it's too late for survivors like Diana Lieb in Altadena. The uncertainty around toxins was the last straw.
There's not much communication about, you know, what is healthy to be around, you know. So.
Lieb put her lot on the market yesterday. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The United States and Israel are at odds with the United Nations over a new aid program for Gaza. Israel says that a private foundation backed by the U.S. is now working to get food to those in need, but U.N. officials say it violates basic principles of neutrality. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The Trump administration describes the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation as a, quote, bold, out-of-the-box effort to make life better for Gazans. Israeli forces and security contractors with two U.S. companies are guarding aid sites that were overrun the first day as Palestinians scrambled to get one of the 8,000 food boxes that would feed a family for several days. Israel's ambassador to the U.N., Danny Danon, downplayed the chaotic start of this new effort.
There were a few riots. It took the American team some time to take control of the situation, but I can say it out loud. We didn't shoot anyone over there.
The United Nations is not taking part in the program that's widely seen as part of Israel's efforts to force Palestinians to move to southern Gaza. The foundation's first leader, a U.S. Marine veteran, quit over the weekend, saying the plan did not adhere to basic humanitarian principles of neutrality. UN envoy Sigrid Kaag puts it this way.
I think the privatization of aid and the weaponization of aid is a very dangerous precedent.
For now, the UN is working in parallel. Kaag told the UN Security Council that after a three-month blockade, Israel has allowed the UN to deliver some aid in recent days.
But this is comparable to a lifeboat after the ship has sunk.
She says the entire population in Gaza is facing the risk of famine. The Security Council also heard harrowing testimony from an American trauma surgeon who has volunteered in Gaza. Feroz Sidwa said he witnessed, in his words, the destruction of Gaza's healthcare system.
This is a deliberate denial of conditions necessary for life: food, shelter, water, and medicine. Preventing genocide means refusing to normalize these atrocities.
The U.S. argues that the war would end if Hamas would release hostages taken more than 600 days ago. It's also calling on the U.N. to cooperate with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Israel's Ambassador Danon says the U.N. is doing the opposite, pressing others not to take part.
Did a shakedown by U.N. mobsters. How can they do that?
Danon says the U.N. hasn't even picked up 400 trucks that are waiting at one of the crossing points. The U.N. Sigrid Kaag says the Israelis have been changing the rules and pressing their military offensive.
Point is, we need to reach all people in Gaza. They shouldn't be displaced again and again just to receive aid.
And she says there must be far more aid getting in. Just today, hundreds of Palestinians broke into a UN warehouse in Gaza. At least four people died in the stampede, according to local hospital sources. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR News.
The Central European country of Hungary, it doesn't have the typical trappings of an autocracy. People here say repression shows up in subtle ways.
It's having your favorite newspaper shut down. It's people being afraid to post online.
Why then are American conservatives gathering here this week? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This year's NBA playoffs have been wild.
Some of the shot making in this series has been really beyond belief. These guys do amazing things.
There have been 6 20-point comeback victories. That is the most in almost 30 years.
That story coming up after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump says he cautioned Israel's prime minister against disrupting U.S. talks with Iran over their nuclear program. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports.
After swearing in the new acting U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, President Trump confirmed to reporters that he had a conversation with Netanyahu about not taking any action that could threaten the sensitive talks with Iran.
I said, I don't think it's appropriate right now, because if we can settle it with a very strong document, very strong, with inspections and no trust, I don't trust anybody.
The comments follow reports that Israel has been preparing for potential strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities if the talks fail. Trump said his team is having good discussions with Iran. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
New York and 15 other states are suing the administration over its actions to drastically cut funding for the National Science Foundation. Here's NPR's Jeff Brumfield.
The lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of New York by a coalition of states' attorneys general. Led by New York and Hawaii, the group says the administration violated the law when it halted funding to programs that increased participation of women and minorities in science. The suit argues that those programs were mandated by Congress. It also seeks to repeal a 15% limit on so-called indirect costs associated with research grants. The Trump administration has said it believes the NSF must refocus purely on fundamental research. It's seeking to slash the Science Foundation's budget next year in half. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
A federal court in Washington has blocked the Trump administration from imposing its sweeping tariffs on imported goods. The president says the country's trade deficit amounts to a national emergency, but the court found that Trump has exceeded his authority. This is NPR. In Kentucky, FEMA crews are on the ground following a deadly EF4 tornado that ripped through the region, killing 19 people this month. Karen Czar with member station WUKY reports on FEMA's progress in one of the hardest hit areas.
President Trump has signed off on a request for federal assistance in 6 Kentucky counties, including Laurel, where 17 of the 19 deaths were reported. FEMA has been on the ground since Saturday, and Public Information Officer Daniel Bernardi said, at this point, most survivors are asking for help meeting immediate needs.
They may have lost a fridge full of food. They may need gasoline, you know, baby formula, diapers, that kind of thing.
Bernardi said help finding and funding temporary housing is also at the top of storm victims' lists. As of Wednesday morning, 35 FEMA disaster recovery centers were open across the state. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in London, Kentucky.
Macy's and Dick's Sporting Goods delivered better than expected results for the latest quarter. Macy's says shoppers are still cautious, partly due to the president's trade war, while Dick's Sporting Goods beat analysts' expectations today and recently bought its rival Foot Locker. Big tech bellwether Nvidia reported robust growth as demand continues to grow for its high-powered chips for artificial intelligence. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station
and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's time now to talk basketball. The New York Knicks have made more big comebacks this postseason than any NBA team in almost 30 years. But they'll need their biggest comeback yet to keep their championship hopes alive. They are down 3-1 to the Indiana Pacers in the Eastern Conference Finals. And across the bracket is another series with a 3-1 lead. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan has been following this. Hey, Becky.
Hey there.
I think if the game were just about celebrities on the sidelines, the Knicks would be winning, right? Timothy Chalamet, Spike Lee, Ben Stiller, they were all at last night's game.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I must say, for the Knicks, the Pacers are winning the actual game. Yeah. So they came, you know, really this started right away. The Pacers came out and kind of seized the confidence away from the Knicks with this, like, devastating game one comeback. Overtime win, and devastating for the Knicks, but incredible for the Pacers. And it gave us this, I think, what is the most iconic moment we've seen yet in this whole year's NBA playoffs, when the Pacers star point guard Tyrese Haliburton made this choke motion that was a reference to when Pacers star Reggie Miller made that motion back to Spike Lee all those years ago during the Patrick Ewing Knicks years, 1994. Game one did feel a little premature for that, I thought, but the Knicks seemingly sort of psychologically have not recovered from that loss. They are now, as you say, down 3-1 with a series on the line tomorrow night in New York.
Is it a surprise that the Pacers are this good?
I think not. I think they really had come on strong over the second half of the season. And so I think a lot of people were expecting this to be competitive. And although it is a 3-1 lead, let me put it a different way. Over the 4 games of this series so far, the Pacers have scored 482 points. The Knicks have scored 471 points. It's a difference of only 11 points.
Yeah.
So a very closely matched series. And a lot of these games have really not been decided, all of them, in fact, until really the final minute or two. Like, I keep thinking, I keep watching, okay, the Pacers have finally put those guys away. That shot was the dagger. And then the Knicks hit a couple incredible shots, and you're like, okay, I guess they're still in it. And it just happens over and over and over again. And so I think even for the guys on the court, they're experiencing it this way. So you had the Pacers head coach Rick Carlisle talking about it like this after yesterday's game.
Some of the shot making in this series has been really beyond belief. These guys do amazing things. So when you can get a stop and a rebound, it almost feels like an anomaly sometimes.
So, you know, could have easily a couple of these games, shots bounce a different way. Maybe it's the Knicks with the series advantage here, but unfortunately for them in NBA playoff history, teams that are up 3-1 have gone on to win that series more than 95% of the time. So for the Knicks to pull it off at this point, it would be truly historic.
All right, let's talk about the Western Conference Finals between the Oklahoma City Thunder and Minnesota Timberwolves. What's going on there?
Well, so we talked about sort of the points, the overall points of that series.
Yeah.
This one is actually even closer by the points. The last one, that was 11-point difference. This is only a 1-point difference over 4 games, but the games just haven't felt as close. So Monday night's was tight, but the other 3 games seemed to have easily been won by one team or the other, I think.
So what's been the difference for the Thunder?
Well, I think they just have the best player on the floor. His name is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We've talked about him before, but if that's an unfamiliar name to listeners, I think now is your chance to commit it to memory, or at least his initials, SGA. He's 26 years old. His sort of NBA origin story is that he was part of this blockbuster trade with the LA Clippers a few years back. And as the years have gone on since then, Gilgeous-Alexander has just gotten better and better and better. And it's become more and more clear every day just how lopsided really that trade ended up being in the Oklahoma City Thunder's favor. This was his best season yet. He led the league in scoring. He was just named the NBA's most valuable player. And the Thunder, to their credit, have built this stellar team around him. And so we have game 5 tonight in Oklahoma. So that series could be wrapped up before all too long.
And NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration says food security is national security. And yet some say Trump's depletion of the federal workforce is putting America's farms at risk. They warn that diseases long eradicated could return, leading to higher food prices and hurdles for farm exports. NPR's Andrea Hsu looks into those concerns.
Ashley Randall is a fifth-generation dairy farmer. She also leads the Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources. They're not a huge farming state, but they do have some famous exports.
Like cranberries and seafood.
And to get those goods out of the country, they need federal employees to certify that they're healthy. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, does some of that, and also helps the state respond to pests and diseases that can wipe out crops and spread through livestock.
Being able to be nimble and respond as quickly as possible is incredibly important.
But Randall says the USDA veterinarian they'd call if a farmer discovered a sick cow has left, taking the government's offer to resign with pay through September. In fact, she's heard many of USDA's area veterinarians in charge have quit.
Our key contacts, just at the state level, are no longer our contacts.
In all, some 1,300 people have resigned from APHIS since February. Those who are still there, and even those who've opted to leave, are fearful of speaking out. But Kevin Shea has been speaking out, and he's not holding back.
It's been pretty shocking.
Shea spent 45 years at USDA, most of that at APHIS. He retired in January.
There's no way APHIS can do its job with 1,300 fewer people. I can't believe that hardly any of them wanted to leave.
He says many were intimidated into leaving, told they could be fired, or that they'd lose their civil service protections, making them easier to fire for any reason. A USDA spokesperson told NPR, APHIS's mission-critical frontline employees were assured their positions were safe, but Shea said people had lost trust. The feeling was the new administration did not understand what APHIS does.
It's essentially keeping pests and diseases out of American agriculture.
Which Shea says they've been pretty successful at doing over the decades.
And that gives us a trade advantage with the rest of the world. And it also creates an abundant, and despite recent price increases in groceries, still comparatively the cheapest food supply around the world.
But you can see how that could change quickly. Avian flu continues to wipe out tens of millions of chickens every year, sending egg prices soaring. Citrus greening disease, caused by a sap-sucking insect, has already wiped out most of Florida's orange crops.
But we're trying to save California. If we don't have a fully functioning APHIS, that's at risk.
And then there are diseases that APHIS already eradicated, like New World screwworm, a parasite that burrows into the open wounds of animals or people. It's resurfaced in Mexico. The U.S. recently halted imports of live animals across the southern border because of this threat. Still, Shea says, there are other ways screwworm could get in.
And so to be that close is concerning.
Those concerns are shared by Beth Thompson, South Dakota's state veterinarian, but she's still holding out to see what the impact of changes at USDA will be.
We're still waiting for, well, what's next?
She has heard that some of APHIS's core work will continue.
Import-export and also disease response will remain priorities for them.
But some programs will probably go away, she says. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins has said she's working to make USDA more efficient and effective for the American people. She lifted the hiring freeze in order to refill some of the roles that have just been vacated. Kevin Shea wonders, where's the efficiency in that?
If this administration had decided they were willing to take risk with a lesser APHIS, okay, that's your prerogative.
But he says encouraging practically every employee to quit could ultimately hurt farmers and ranchers and the food system Americans depend on. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Torpedo baseball bats hit it big when the Yankees set a new team record with 9 home runs in a game early this season. People noticed the oddly shaped bats that seemed to give players more pop at the plate. Alana Schreiber with member station WWNO in New Orleans visited one of the companies making bats that are all the rage.
I'm in heaven. This is a baseball lover's dream.
I'm standing in a conference room at Marucci Sports in Baton Rouge. Bats line the walls all the way up to the ceiling. They're one of the top companies making these new torpedo bats. I'm with Kurt Ainsworth, co-founder and CEO. Even he was amazed at how much people were talking about these bats.
It was not your normal just ESPN or MLB Network talking about baseball. It was people with Fox News and CNN talking about baseball. So it became everybody that's not even baseball fans know about torpedo.
Anyone who looks at a torpedo bat can tell. What makes them unique is their shape.
I mean, it looks like a bowling pin. I mean, they call it a torpedo because it sounds cooler, but it really does look like a bowling pin.
Traditional bats get bigger the higher up you go, but torpedo bats bulge out about 3/4 of the way up and thin out at the top. In other words, there's a bigger sweet spot.
It's basically taking the girth and the size of the end of the bat and moving it into the hitting space, so it gives the player a better chance for success.
So let's say a major leaguer wants a torpedo bat. First, he comes to Baton Rouge. Here, he'll meet with Micah Gibbs at Marucci's Baseball Performance Lab. He's worked with some of the MLB's biggest stars.
Paul Goldschmidt, Nolan Arenado, Alex Bregman, Francisco Lindor.
Gibbs says a lot goes into finding the perfect bat for a player.
We have a fitting matrix. We have a bunch of different bats, different weights, weight distributions. We put them through an entire physical assessment before they even start swinging.
But once they do start swinging, Gibbs takes a video, and a computer analyzes the player as they hit. Wherever they make the most contact, that's where the bat will be thicker.
So the bats come in as a billet of wood, and we will cut it into the shape of the bat, whatever that player specified for their bat.
That's Sager Allen, a wood operator. He's showing me the factory side of the business, where they cut and sand every bat.
We have, I want to say, over 70,000 different models we can cut and make, so there's definitely an art form to it.
After the bats are cut, sanded, and weighed, they head over to the painting department, where they're eventually inscribed with the player's often illegible signature. Then they're shipped to the athletes to test out. But I wanted to test out these bats, too. We head to Marucci's on-site batting cages, the same ones where major leaguers are getting fitted. But I'm not worried. I've played 2 seasons in an adult softball league. I've brought along Marty Sullivan. He's an LSU sports reporter, and today, my pitcher. He starts throwing, and I start swinging.
It's always more of an opposite field kind of hitter.
And you can feel it. The sweet spot is bigger. So big, in fact, that earlier in the season, some wondered if the bats might get banned. But Tyler Kepner, senior baseball writer for The Athletic, isn't too worried.
I think it's just an innovation for the hitters, honestly. And we've seen a lot of advancements the last few years in pitching technology. And so I think this is just one time when the hitters are fighting back a little bit.
In other words, baseball is constantly evolving. And these torpedo bats are just the latest innovation in pushing the limits of the game. For NPR News, I'm Alana Schreiber in Baton Rouge.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. To the bizarre story now of an Italian man kidnapped and tortured for nearly 3 weeks in a townhouse in New York City in an effort to separate him from his fortune. Now, the would-be thieves were not after his worldly possessions, at least not tangible ones. They wanted his Bitcoin password. Three people have now been arrested in this case, which is one of a growing number of violent physical attacks on cryptocurrency investors. And a warning, this conversation includes details of those attacks. Jeff John Roberts has written about all this for Fortune magazine. He is here now. Hey there.
Hi, Mary Louise. Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. So this latest incident came to light when the victim managed to escape. That was last Friday. But I gather attacks like this are becoming common enough that there's a term for them. Why are they called wrench attacks?
Yeah, there's got a funny backstory to it. It's from a popular meme because a lot of crypto people are very technically savvy.
Sure.
And are very proud of the digital locks they put around their crypto to guard it. But there's this meme that shows of how the crypto people think this will protect them, but they have a picture of a bad guy who's like, oh, he's got a password. Take this $5 wrench and hit him with it until he tells it to you. So the point being that even if you have really, really good digital security, if you're being beaten with a wrench, you're probably going to tell the password and the security won't do you any good anymore.
And how common is this? And how do we know? Who's tracking it?
There's a guy named Jameson Lopp, who in my world is called an OG Bitcoin guy, and he's got a sort of running tally of them. And these aren't new. I mean, they've gone on for years. They've gone on since early Bitcoin. But as the price of Bitcoins, you know, goes up, the payoff for robbing someone is obviously higher. And the security's gotten better, too. It's harder to hack them. So we're seeing, I think, more, more wrench attacks take place these days.
No, are we talking like, what, single digits, dozens a year? What are we talking?
I think there's a couple dozen last year, and there's been a number this year already, you know, at least a dozen, maybe a few dozen, including one in France where they grabbed this crypto executive and cut one of his fingers off and bound his girlfriend and put him in a car.
Sorry, cut one of his fingers off?
Yeah, they cut off one of his fingers, but he ended up safe in the end, but minus the finger. And there was another one in France recently where they found their wealthy crypto person in the trunk of a car covered in gasoline. I mean, it's very scary stuff.
Well, what is being done about this? You write about how the crypto industry is taking notice and trying to combat it. What are they doing?
Well, I think it's sort of a bit of cultural awareness. You know, don't go bragging about your wealth and, you know, where you are, because this can happen to you. Bodyguards are very popular with crypto people, too. And there's been a real sort of interest in, you know, a lot of top crypto people don't go anywhere without a bodyguard. And then the final thing I wrote about is there's actually wrench attack insurance. Just as you'd insure your safety deposit box or something else, you can buy insurance for your Bitcoin, which means if something like this happens to you, you can simply give them the password rather than having to make this very hard decision. One of the products is backed by Lloyd's of London, which is, you know, of course, is, you know, centuries old insurance firm. But I haven't spoken to someone yet who's filed a successful claim. But I did speak to some of the people who are offering this product, and they say hundreds of people have purchased it. So, you know, but again, with these sort of things, when you're robbed, it's often done quite, you know, discreetly, and people don't want to publicize it, you know, so they're not attacked again. So it's very possible claims have been filed we haven't heard about yet.
Jeff John Roberts, he's finance and crypto editor for Fortune magazine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
President Trump's deep cuts to the federal government have had ripple effects here in Washington, D.C. The city's chief financial officer says the local economy has taken a hit, forcing local leaders into taking some drastic steps. WAMU's Alex Coma reports.
After some difficult days in the wake of the pandemic, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser called 2024 the city's comeback year. The district's population was growing again, and crime numbers were falling. But Bowser says that was before anyone had ever heard of the Department of Government Efficiency.
We got hit with the DOGE economy.
Federal workers fuel the city's economy, traditionally insulating the district against economic downturns affecting the rest of the country. But the Trump administration's push to shrink the size of the government has upended that equilibrium, leaving many D.C. residents unable to spend the way they did, or worse, forcing them to flee the region entirely. The warnings from the city's chief financial officer are grim. D.C. stands to lose 40,000 jobs over the next 4 years, leading to roughly $1 billion in lost revenue. Bowser responded by proposing deep cuts in her new 2026 budget this week, primarily focusing on human services. The city's Medicaid, food stamp, and paid family leave programs could all see substantial reductions, cuts which would fall hardest on the city's poorest residents. But Bowser is simultaneously pressing for some new investments meant to grow the economy, chief among them $1 billion to build a new football stadium for the Washington Commanders.
The activity there and the private dollars that are being attracted to that site will continue to spur interest.
Bowser has paired these proposals with nods towards deregulation, aiming to slash tenant protections and clean energy requirements to attract more development. And she hopes to abandon planned increases to D.C.'s tip minimum wage in a bid to help restaurant owners who say rising labor costs are hammering their businesses. D.C. Chamber of Commerce head Shanira Hubbard argues that the city can't afford to wait to make changes like this now.
We, from the business community perspective, really see a lot of upsides to make it easier to do business in D.C., to attract businesses in D.C.
But all these cuts and policy changes have also attracted intense resistance. Elizabeth Falcon, the head of D.C. Jobs with Justice, says she can't understand why the city would respond to these federal disruptions by handing over public money to a billionaire football team owner and slashing supports for vulnerable people while so many are losing their jobs.
There's a really false dichotomy that's being raised here that requires, like, reducing the risks and benefits that D.C. has made in commitments to workers and tenants in order to ensure a thriving and functional private sector.
These difficult choices will surely prompt contentious conversations with the D.C. Council, which will be able to make changes to Bowser's proposal over the next 2 months before they vote on it. At-large councilmember Robert White argues the city risks pushing its poorest residents out of D.C. if it pulls back on these safety net programs so aggressively.
I don't want us to pretend like we don't know the potential impact if we don't make the right decisions now.
Yesham Sayam has studied the city's economy for years as the head of the D.C. Policy Center. She believes there's some merit to Bowser's efforts here, but she also cautions that the size of the city's problems are so vast that more challenging cuts are likely in the future without more money coming in.
Maybe we have solved a structural budget problem by some ugly arithmetic, but it's going to lead to incredibly difficult decisions.
Sayan notes that Bowser's budget also calls for substantial school spending cuts 2 years from now if the city's revenue picture doesn't improve. That could prompt some bruising political fights. For NPR News in Washington, D.C., I'm Alex Coma.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org.